From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, we hear from one of today's most idiosyncratic and critically acclaimed young directors. Jim Jarmusch made the movies Stranger Than Paradise, Down by Law, and Mystery Train, which just came out on home video. Also today, singer and guitarist Robert Cray talks with us about bringing the sounds of blues and soul into the 90s. This year is the 100th anniversary of the birth of Jelly Roll Morton. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of a new collection of Morton's early recordings. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews the latest look at the life of Greta Garbo. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. U.S. Defense Secretary Dick Cheney testified today against letting economic sanctions remain in place against Iraq for as long as some have proposed. Cheney said the U.S. could not afford to wait indefinitely for the sanctions to work. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Cheney, along with General Colin Powell, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, appeared before the Senate Armed Services Committee in the final day of this round of hearings into the administration's Gulf policy. Contrary to other witnesses who have testified the sanctions should be given a year or so to bite, Cheney said while the U.S. waits, Iraqi President Saddam Hussein continues to dig in.
It's possible that at some point the military effort that might be required to get him out will be more difficult in the future than it is today.
Cheney said that, in his view, Saddam can ride out the sanctions and that the passage of time increases the economic pressure on other nations such as Egypt and Jordan. Cheney also testified that, in his view, President Bush does not need any congressional authorization to launch a military strike against Iraq. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
Also in Washington, the State Department says about 88 Americans are now being held as so-called human shields in Iraq. Several hundred Americans, however, remain trapped in both Iraq and Kuwait. Over the weekend, 15 Americans were allowed to leave Iraq, and the State Department says that 10 of them have special medical conditions. U.S. officials say that house-to-house searches continue in occupied Kuwait. President Bush is in Brazil on the first of a five-nation, six-day tour of Latin America designed to promote his proposals for free trade in the hemisphere. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Mr. Bush is here to personally consult with Brazilian President Fernando Collor about the Enterprise for the Americas initiative. That's Mr. Bush's proposal for promoting investment and free trade while reducing Latin America's debt. Latin America's civilian leaders have reacted positively to the plan. Today, the president acknowledged that the changes he proposes will cause some hardship in Latin America.
In the short run, economic change will be difficult and painful for many. But the long-term results, a growing economy and a sound currency, will lead to new opportunities and a better quality of life for all the people of Brazil.
President Bush travels tomorrow to Uruguay and then on to Argentina on Wednesday. Mr. Bush says he has full confidence in his security there, despite the mutiny of some military officers. I'm Richard Gonzalez with the president in Brasilia, Brazil.
In Argentina, the last of several hundred rebel troops who tried to force a shakeup of the Army High Command has now surrendered. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up almost 6 points to close at 2,565.59, volume some 177 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Jim Jarmusch is one of the few young film directors who's managed to make very idiosyncratic movies that are also widely distributed and attract large audiences. New York Times film critic Vincent Canby called him the most adventurous and arresting filmmaker to surface in the American cinema of the 80s. Jarmusch's movies include Stranger Than Paradise, Down by Law, and Mystery Train, which has just come out on home video. Jarmusch's stories are offbeat, and so are the actors he casts. In fact, some of the actors are better known as musicians, such as Tom Waits and John Lurie, who also scores Jarmusch's films. The cast of Mystery Train includes Joe Strummer of the British band The Clash and rhythm and blues stars Rufus Thomas and Screamin' Jay Hawkins. The settings and stories of Jarmusch's movies are also influenced by music. Mystery Train is set in Memphis. The film opens with two teenage Japanese tourists who've made Memphis a stop on their rock and roll pilgrimage to America. They plan on visiting Graceland and the Sun Studios, where Elvis, Jerry Lee Lewis, Roy Orbison, and Carl Perkins all recorded. The parts of Memphis that Jarmusch shows are run down and abandoned. I asked him if he had made a pilgrimage to Memphis before he began making the film.
I actually hadn't been to Memphis until after having written the script for the film, so I wasn't really quite sure what to expect. But I'm always more drawn to the more unusual places in a city, or the back street kind of areas in a city.
Well, why are you more interested in the back streets of a city? That's not the kind of section you grew up in, is it?
Well, I grew up in Akron, Ohio, so I think I have some kind of innate nostalgia for, like, post-industrial landscapes or something. I like those kind of areas. It's funny because usually people film in cities and they try to film recognizable cliches of the city or recognizable landscapes so that people know that that's the city they're filming in. If you film in Seattle, you have to have a Space Needle. If you film in New Orleans, you have to have the Superdome Stadium or whatever. And I don't know, I just prefer to avoid the kind of things that most people would use as a kind of cliche or an identifying image of a city, because real people live in the back streets. They don't just visit the kind of places that you would see in postcards.
You said that you want your audiences to be more interested in character than plot. Why?
Well, I'm more interested in characters than in plots. I don't know why. I get kind of bored with the predictability of plots and the fact that you can usually guess what's going to happen in a film after the first 10 minutes. And instead, what's more interesting to me are characters. And my films are not about very complicated plots. They're not really story oriented to the degree of most films. Narrative films with characters in them are about people.
The characters tend to be pretty directionless. There's not a lot of action in your movies. Are you reacting against a certain kind of movie with that too?
Not so much reacting against it, because I like a lot of action films myself, but there seem to be so many of them that I would prefer to, I don't know, my interest leads me toward the characters rather than, you know, special effects and action and that kind of stuff. I like the really simple things, little things that happen between people, often even between moments of dialogue. So I'm just interested in those things. I also have a bad habit that only occurred to me recently. When I'm watching films that are relatively predictable, I find myself not following the plot and imagining scenes that aren't in the film, but that might, you know, things that happen as that would be transitional but are not in the film. They're not necessary because they want to follow the action. And I kind of drift off and imagine all kinds of scenes that are not even in the films I'm watching, which then, of course, I end up missing the key scenes in the film. But I don't know. I'm just interested in I think insights often are more, there are greater insights just in those little spaces between things.
Can you give an example of an imaginary scene that you were diverted by in a recent movie?
I can't think of a specific example, but if you say you're watching a film and a guy has an argument over the phone with his girlfriend and it cuts back and forth between them, and then it cuts to him entering her apartment, I might stop to imagine, you know, how did he get to her apartment so fast? Did he walk? Did he drive? Did he take the subway? What was he thinking? Was he angry? Is it 1 hour later? Is it 5 hours later? And by the time I've imagined half of those things, I miss the scene that's going on between him and the girl in the apartment.
So your film might be more about the trip getting over to the girlfriend's house than about what happened afterwards or before.
Yeah, I think my films are, in a sense, made up of those in-between scenes that other people would eliminate. For example, in Down by Law, the film, there's a key in the plot. They escape from prison, and normally you would spend a lot of time developing, you know, how do they get out of prison? Do they carve a gun out of soap and dye it with shoe polish, or is there a file baked into a cake or whatever. And in this, in my film, I just wasn't interested in exactly how they got out. I just wanted them to get out. So I pretty much eliminated all those, the plot detail. And in one scene, they're talking about the possibility of escape. And in the next scene, they're escaping. So I tend to leave out a lot of the action stuff, things that explain the plot, which really doesn't interest me so much.
My guest is film director and screenwriter Jim Jarmusch. I have to say, I think your movies have a very low libido. Libido level.
A low libido level.
Yeah.
Gee, I don't know how to take that.
Well, no. Well, the films are seldom about the character's sexuality. And there's very little sex in the movies. And this is in a period when so many movies are explicitly or implicitly about sexual magnetism.
Well, it becomes so cliched, you know. What I don't like, and there's a sex scene in Mystery Train which I intentionally wanted to.
They seem very bored.
Well, they're not good at it, basically.
Yeah, right.
I mean, they're very young and they're not good at it, and it happens too fast, and then they feel funny about it, so they have a kind of invented argument because of their own insecurity, which the scene was about young, about being making love when you're young and not really knowing how to do it so well. And the vulnerability that they feel just after.
Mm-hmm.
But, low libido level. But what bothers me are these Hollywood, you know, these kind of cliched sex scenes where everyone, it's like we are sexual athletes, and aren't we good at this? Which I find pretty boring. I mean, that's not really, sex can be so many different things. It can be funny, it can be frustrating, it can be annoying, it can be really wonderful. But in the movies, it's always like athletics, which, I don't know, I just find that boring.
Mm-hmm. You know, we've been talking about how you're more interested in character than in plot, and I think you have a great sense of casting. You've worked with a lot of actors who aren't really actors, they're not trained actors. A lot of them are actually musicians or come from music backgrounds. I'm thinking of John Lurie, who also scores most of your films, Tom Waits, who co-starred in Down by Law, Joe Strummer from The Clash is in your new film. When you're looking for an actor who isn't a professional actor, what do you look for in them to give you the confidence that they'll do well in your film? Are you looking for their kind of attitude and style in a way?
Well, I don't really look for non-actors. I just tend to get ideas for people that I have some sense of already. They're either friends of mine or people whose work that interests me as an actor. So my films have a variety of different levels of experience among the actors. Some are very experienced and some are not experienced at all. But what I look for is something that will inspire me to create a character, basically. And most of these, many of the actors I've worked with, I've written characters specifically for them. Now, that doesn't mean that they are playing themselves in the film, but that there are certainly elements of their own personality that is also in the character, and there are elements of their own personality that is not in the character and is therefore suppressed or not not amplified like elements that would be in the character.
The first time I saw Richard Edson in a movie, it was in your film Stranger Than Paradise, and I guess it was 1984. And he's since become also known for his role as the non-racist son of Danny Aiello in Do the Right Thing. Tell me about casting him. Perhaps he was in movies before yours, but I don't think I saw them.
No, he wasn't. In fact, I think Stranger was his first role. And Richard is also a musician. And when I first knew him in the late 70s, early 80s, I knew him through music. He was in different groups in New York. So I don't know. He was just someone that I knew and who had a really a wonderful quality about him. And I thought he would be interesting for the character of Eddie in Stranger Than Paradise. And certainly now that I've made the film, looking back, I can't possibly imagine anybody else being that character.
Well, let's take a break, and then we'll talk some more. And my guest is film director Jim Jarmusch. This is Fresh Air. Film director and screenwriter Jim Jarmusch is my guest. We've been talking about how you cast a lot of musicians in your movies. You used to be in a band yourself, didn't you?
Yes. Next question.
What kind of band was it?
Oh, no. Next question about the film, please.
You don't want to talk about the band?
No, I'd rather not. It was very important to me being in a band, but I'm not really a musician. I consider myself a non-musician. I would like to do some music in the near future, too, but I don't really want people to go out and look for the records that my...
Oh, there's records, too.
Oh, see?
See, you shouldn't have given that away. We didn't know that.
I'm digging my own grave here.
You spent a year in Paris. I think this is when you were in college, is that right?
Yeah, my last year. I studied literature here in New York at Columbia. And then my last year, I went to Paris to study for one semester and ended up staying there for a year.
Were you introduced to many American films through a French perspective while you were living there?
Yeah, I was. In fact, a lot of films, a lot of American film directors, a lot of work of American film directors, my attention was brought to them through French film, French writers or French Nouvelle Vague directors who were also writers. I would read something Godard wrote about Howard Hawks or Sam Fuller or something that Jacques Rivette wrote about John Ford, etc. And it's funny that my interest in American cinema came largely through first an interest in European cinema.
Do you think that that's affected the way you make movies? I mean, Mystery Train seems to be very influenced by Godard, especially the first segment.
Well, I'm sure it has, although I'm not the best person to be very analytical about it. Mm-hmm. I'm sure it has. I mean, I think I'm inspired a lot by European films and Japanese films, but also a lot by American films.
You studied with Nicholas Ray?
Yes, I worked as a teaching assistant with Nick Ray and was with him up until his death, for about a year and a half before his death, I worked with him.
His films include Johnny Guitar and Rebel Without a Cause. Is there any way you could summarize some of the things that you learned by working with Ray?
Well, I learned so many things. He taught me to think of each scene in a film as something, to concentrate on each scene as you're shooting it, as you're rehearsing it, and not to confuse them, not to think about, you know, scene A, scene B, scene C together, but to isolate them while you think about them. He also taught me not to talk to the actors in a general way, that each actor should be dealt with individually because what you are doing is collaborating with that one actor to make a character. And what you speak to that actor about, you shouldn't necessarily let the other actors hear because it doesn't relate to their work. So he taught me to really concentrate on a kind of collaboration with each actor. He also taught me to that films should be influenced or inspired by things other than cinema, by literature, by painting, by baseball, by, you know, whatever interests you, but most importantly by observing and listening to dialogue that you just overhear in real places.
You met the German director Wim Wenders, who's made several American films, I believe through Nicholas Ray, because Wenders made a film about Ray called Lightning Over Water.
Right.
Wenders helped you out in making your first or one of your first films.
Well, Wim's company, which at the time was in New York called Gray City, gave me film material, film stock that was left over from a film that Wim made called The State of Things. So, and I met Wim through Nick, and to be honest, at first, when I was an assistant to Nick on the film Lightning Over Water and hardly even spoke to Wim throughout that experience. But since then, I got to know him very well, and he's really a close friend. I really like his work a lot.
My guest is film director Jim Jarmusch, and his movies include Stranger Than Paradise, Down by Law, and the new film Mystery Train. So you had this limited amount of film stock to get started and make a movie, and from the way I understand it, you shot the first part of Stranger Than Paradise using that stock, and to make every minute of it count, you Instead of doing lots of takes and editing it down to just a few good minutes, you rolled the camera and used a good deal of what you shot. I know you were doing that at the time to save money, but what did you learn from taking that approach that's affected the way you make movies since?
Well, I learned that you should think of limitations as strengths, and therefore you can kind of defeat them as being limiting. I think that if you try to turn things around in that way, you can learn a lot. I'm very interested and inspired by a Japanese director, Ozu, that also Wim Wenders likes a lot. He made a film called Tokyo Ga that largely deals with Ozu. But Ozu used limitations to the extent that he used a single lens for all of his films, only one lens. He used only two camera positions, two heights of the camera off the floor only, and he never moved his camera. And yet his films and the language, the film language that is developed in his films is so strong and powerful and even elegant at times, and yet so minimal that by taking those limitations, he made something incredibly strong out of them. So I try to think in those terms, to use the limitations, to think of them as strengths and not think of them as restraints, but something that could possibly make the film stronger.
Because one of your early films was shot with limited film stock and without a lot of retakes, have you incorporated that type of approach into your later films?
Yeah, I find myself, in fact, repeating a lot of things that I like. For example, in my very first film, Permanent Vacation, the only way that I could get a shot of the character walking down the street was to put the camera in a car and push the car along the street. So I had a very flat kind of angle on him with him in profile walking down the street and the landscape around him in the frame and the camera following him, which is something I again used in Stranger Than Paradise. I used it in the opening of Down by Law. I used it also in Mystery Train. And in Mystery Train, we had a good-sized budget, but we didn't have enough money for tracks to do traveling shots for all the scenes we wanted to. So we found ourselves again doing the same thing, mounting the camera in a car, a station wagon, and having six or seven people push it and doing traveling shots in this way. So there are certain things that repeat. Also, the idea that I really don't like to move the camera unless it is following a character. It's something just kind of idiosyncrasy that I have. I see other people do it, and it's sometimes really dramatic, and I like it a lot, but it's something I don't want to do. For example, if a character is sitting in a chair, I don't like the idea of traveling in on them while they're static for a dramatic effect. I only want to move the camera if the character is, in fact, moving.
Why not come in for a close-up?
Because for me, the camera then becomes a character itself. It's somehow I have broken a kind of observational thread between the audience and the action. And now the camera is telling the audience that this must be important because we are moving in on it, and therefore we are imparting meaning by moving the camera, which I think is somehow antithetical to the style, at least in the... I mean, I'm not saying I would never do that, but talking about the films I've made thus far, that would not be in keeping with the intention of the style.
You're one of those people one of the few people who's managed to have a film career without making big-budget studio productions, yet have their films really be seen by a large audience. I mean, you're hardly an underground director now, so to speak. Is that the kind of area you'd like to stay in?
Yeah, I would. I just want to be able to make the kind of films that I want to make without being told how to make them. So somehow I would not say that I would never want to make a film in a studio or with, you know, in Hollywood or whatever. I wouldn't mind doing that as long as I'm making my film. I don't want to make a film that someone else tells me to make for them. That I just wouldn't be good at.
I want to go out with Elvis Presley's version of Blue Moon, which you play through the movie. Tell me why you chose that recording.
Well, I liked the... I could go into a very long-winded answer about my feelings about Elvis. I'm not a big Elvis fan, although I think he was a really great performer. I was more interested in him as an icon. But Blue Moon is particularly interesting because it's a very minimal arrangement of a Rodgers and Hart song, but using a very minimal rockabilly arrangement. And it's something that the minimalness of the instruments and the use of Elvis's falsetto I find particularly haunting.
Blue moon, you saw me standing alone without a dream in my heart, without love of my own. Blue moon, you knew just what I was there for. You heard me saying a prayer for someone I really could care for.
Elvis Presley, from the soundtrack recording of Mystery Train, the latest film by Jim Jarmusch. Mystery Train has just been released on home video. Next time, education historian Diane Ravitch on the need for multicultural textbooks that don't distort history in the name of racial and ethnic pride. Ravitch consulted on rewriting California history textbooks, and she's just put together a multicultural reader. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead continues his survey of new box sets with a review of the new 5-CD compilation, The Complete Victor Recordings of Jelly Roll Morton. Robert Cray has become one of this country's most popular blues and soul musicians. Coming up, Cray tells us what he doesn't relate to about the blues. And this week, Ted Turner's TNT television network is paying tribute to film star Greta Garbo. TV critic David Bianculli tells us what's worth watching and what's not. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Bill Bradlin. At least 8 people were killed and 20 injured this afternoon when 2 Northwest Airlines jets collided at Detroit Metropolitan Airport while they were taxiing on the ground. The Wayne County, Michigan Medical Examiner's Office and Wayne County Executive Edward McNamara say Northwest's statement earlier that 19 people had died, as NPR reported, was wrong. Involved in the crash were a DC-9 and a 727, both operated by Northwest. At the time of the accident, visibility was poor and the ground was wet from a morning snow and sleet storm. Apparently, most of the dead and injured were on the DC-9, which was nearly destroyed by the fire which occurred when the planes collided. The U.S. Supreme Court has declined to write a big loophole into its celebrated Miranda decision. By a vote of 6-2, the High Court strengthened the rights of criminal suspects in police custody. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
The Supreme Court, in its famous Miranda decision, ruled that suspects in custody must be warned of their rights to remain silent and to have an attorney. The court said in 1966 that unless the suspect waives those rights, nothing he says can be used against him at his trial. This year, prosecutors in Mississippi, backed by the Bush administration, asked the Supreme Court to carve out a big exception to that rule. The prosecutors asked the court to allow a suspect's confession if he's already talked to his lawyer and then makes incriminating statements to police afterwards. With the Supreme Court now dominated by conservatives, the expectation was that the prosecutor's argument would get a friendly reception. But today, the justices, by a 6-2 vote, firmly rejected the prosecutorial plea for an exception to the Miranda rule. Writing for the court, Justice Anthony Kennedy said that when a suspect in custody requests a lawyer, interrogation must cease and officials may not reinitiate interrogation without a lawyer present. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
Israeli police have instituted a series of new measures limiting Palestinian free access from the Israeli-occupied territories into Israel. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Starting tomorrow, police will set up dozens of roadblocks on main roads leading from the West Bank into Israel. Palestinians who want to enter will have to undergo a body search and their cars will be checked. All policemen will also carry weapons. The new measures come after yesterday's stabbing attack on an intercity bus. 3 Palestinians from a village near Nablus stabbed 4 Israeli passengers, killing one of them. A police spokesman said they will consider issuing guns to bus drivers for self-protection. Also today, 12 Arabs who tried to attack a crowd of Israelis on a beach last May were each sentenced to 30 years in prison. 4 other infiltrators were killed in the attack. The Arabs were affiliated with the Popular Liberation Front of Abu Abbas. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
On Wall Street, stock prices closed higher today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose nearly 6 points to 2565.59. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. This past October 20th marked the 100th anniversary of the birth of Jelly Roll Morton. The New Orleans-born pianist has been called the first great composer in jazz. He died in 1941. In honor of his centennial, there's a new Morton box set, which includes all of the sessions he led for the Victor label between 1926 and 1930, as well as one from 1939. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review.
On one level, Jelly Roll Morton's blueprint for art was simple. He took the neatly tailored music of ragtime and the messy improvised stuff called the blues, combined the two, and turned them into something else. That's Jelly Roll Morton's Jungle Blues, recorded with his band the Red Hot Peppers in 1927. It's from a series of recordings Morton did for the Victor label. They're universally considered his best work. In the 20s, even more than now, jazz musicians were seen as intuitive artists who played from the gut. But Morton always knew exactly what he was doing and why. He rehearsed his bands intensively before they went into the studio, where, by the way, they were exceptionally well recorded for the time. More than any other early jazz man, Morton was interested in variety and shifting textures. That's something he got from classic rags, with their contrasting themes and variations on themes. Here's part of Morton's Black Bottom Stomp, the first of his Victor recordings. Jelly Roll Morton's detractors say he had a shaky sense of rhythm, but that swings pretty good for 1926. By then, ragtime was considered old-fashioned, one reason a lot of people in jazz looked down on Morton. Another reason was his abrasive personality. Jelly Roll was a braggart, quick to praise himself and slow to credit others. Even the gracious Duke Ellington had nothing good to say about him. For those reasons, historians write about Morton as if he were making music in a vacuum, neither influencing nor being influenced by anyone else. But Ellington certainly learned a lot about musical structure from Morton. Duke's early masterpiece, Black and Tan Fantasy, owed a lot to Jelly Roll's Dead Man Blues. And Morton, despite his stubborn independence, had been keeping his ears open, too. In 1929, he recorded his New Orleans Bump, which showed what he'd picked up from Ellington. At the time Morton made his best recordings, jazz was going in an entirely different direction. His stuff was highly arranged, real composer's music. But jazz was becoming the art of the soloist, mostly due to Louis Armstrong. Even Morton's critical admirers say he had few disciples. Oddly enough, he's more influential now than when he was around. Modern jazz musicians, looking to make their pieces more than just one solo after another, are discovering that Morton had solved that problem long before other folks knew it existed. Players as diverse as the conservative Wynton Marsalis and the innovative Henry Threadgill are playing his pieces and echoing his strategies. So RCA's new 5-CD set of 111 Morton performances comes at just the right time. 100 years after his birth, jazz still has a lot to learn from Jelly Roll Morton.
Kevin Whitehead is a frequent contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed the complete Victor recordings of Jelly Roll Morton on RCA. This is Fresh Air. Robert Cray has been hailed for reviving the blues, but he's also reviving the soul sound of the 60s. In fact, the Memphis horns, which used to back Otis Redding, are now in Cray's band. Unlike many of his predecessors, Cray's music isn't rooted in one region. He moved around a lot as a child, living on military bases in the Southeast and Northwest, as well as in Germany. Cray has been leading a band since 1974 and recording since 1978. A couple of singles from his 1986 album, Strong Persuader, were international hits. Cray has a new album called Midnight Stroll. From that album, this is My Problem.
It's my own fault, yes it is. I'm so ashamed, can't blame it on no one else. She was once my everything. I sit here alone.
The kind of soul and rhythm and blues that you sing are really dependent on the singer communicating feeling. That feeling is often pain.
Mm-hmm.
When you were younger, were you ever frustrated having a younger voice, a voice that hadn't really experienced all of the stuff it was singing about, and a voice that maybe, you know, sounded younger and sounded less
worn? I know what you're
saying. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean. You know, to tell the truth, you know, when I started listening to a lot of blues and the rhythm and blues things, I was really interested in the guitar work.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I can listen to those records that I listened to back then now and understand them in a whole different way. I think that the fact that you get a little bit older and you've gone through a certain amount of relationships, that you understand what these guys were singing about a long time ago.
What came first for you, singing or playing guitar?
Playing guitar. And I didn't get into singing until one day one of the, a singer quit on right before an audition.
An audition for what?
An audition for a high school dance.
And so you figured you'd try it? Or were you assigned to do it?
I always sang background, you know, for some of the songs we did, but I never took the lead chores until that time.
And you liked it?
Yeah, I enjoy it now.
And then?
Well, you know, as you go along, I mean, you know, you start off and you're really nervous. And in the early days of the Cray Band, I mean, I couldn't even say anything to people, between songs. Richard Cousins, our bass player, he always had to announce the songs, and I'd just stand back there almost with my back turned to the audience and just walk up to sing. So, you know, it was difficult.
When did you start singing blues?
Started singing blues, when we started this band, actually. Well, in 74. But I'd been in a couple of bands that did a lot of rehearsing and no playing for about a year or so before that.
Were there parts of the blues you didn't relate to?
Yeah, there's a whole lot of the blues that I didn't relate to. Basically, being that I'm from a military background and being on the West Coast, I mean, you find it hard to try to picture some of the elder bluesmen being down in the South and living the lives that they had to live back in those days, coming from plantations and playing for the little dances and fish fries and things like that. All these things were very interesting, but it was a whole different kind of thing that I couldn't relate to. But the main thing about it was what I liked about the music was the emotion.
Mm-hmm.
I liked the fact that there was a guy named Howling Wolf. with a name like Howling Wolf, and then when you put on his record, he would howl. and he would always make his midnight creep and come out, and his voice was such that it would scare you into believing what he was talking about.
A lot of the songs that you sing are really about things you probably could relate to. Do you
mm-hmm.
know what I mean? They're not standard blues lyrics.
as if there's a standard, but there is a kind of variation on the theme.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking of a song like Right Next Door, mm-hmm. which was on your Strong Persuader album. This is the story of a musician who's on the road. He's in a hotel room. He's had an affair with the woman in the next room. And he's listening through the walls, and he can hear that her boyfriend's breaking up with her. Did you write that song?
No, I had had a lot to do with the music of it, but Dennis Walker, our producer and good friend I've known since 77, wrote that song. There's some funny things about Dennis Walker I always, always have to mention. He comes up with some great ideas. You see, Dennis is a happily married man, but he's been married 3 times, so I wonder sometimes.
I heard him shout, "Who is he?" She mumbled low. He said, "Baby, don't you lie to me no more." And I'm listening through these thin walls, silent shame, as he called out my name. I was right next door. It's because of me. It's because of me. Because of me. Such a strong persuader, but she was just another notch on my guitar. She's gonna lose the man that really loves her. In the silence, I can hear their breaking heart. Oh.
Well, I have to tell you, you know, everybody who works on Fresh Air has been stopping into my office and saying, "Listen, you really ought to ask him if he lives those lyrics, you know, if he's really been around as much as those lyrics would imply." You know, if he's been the backdoor man a lot, is what a lot of people have suggested I ask you.
Well, you know, you can believe some of the stories, but then you can't believe everything now. That's all I'll say.
Fine. It's kind of paradoxical, you know, the music that you sing comes out of Black culture, but I think nowadays there's largely a white audience for blues and soul and some kinds of rhythm and blues. Mm-hmm. Does that jive with what you've perceived? I mean, with the
That's reality? Exactly what's going on. There's a thing where a lot of blues and rhythm and blues isn't getting played on radio, except for if you listen to public broadcasting, and a few college radio stations. That's about it. And also for the fact that a lot of blacks have shunned the blues, so to speak. They don't listen to it anymore. So when you do hear it, it's usually around a college or it's on public broadcasting. And so therefore, it's just that's basically it.
Why do you think that is? And why do you think it is that a lot of black listeners have given up on blues?
Well, I think for a lot of people, it's the fact that it reminds us of the old times, something everybody wants to get away from. To better themselves in white American society, you have to get rid of the past. And I think blues music has to go along with it.
When you were getting started, you toured with bluesman Albert Collins.
Right.
What did that open your eyes up about? Anything? You know, you were still young and probably very impressionable.
Exactly. The first time I saw him was in 69, and I saw him outdoors playing guitar behind his back. He was really loud because he's from Texas. Most Texas musicians are loud. And He really impressed me like that, you know. And we got a chance to work with Albert, and it really showed me how to play a supportive role behind a musician such as him. Also, we traveled with him quite a bit, and he taught us how to pack, you know, for going out on the road, things like that, how to collect our money from corrupt club owners, and just what kind of attitude to take out with you when you went out on the road. Simple things like that.
I'd be interested in some of the things he shared with you about how to collect money from corrupt club owners.
I'd rather not talk about those things now.
Why not?
Oh, I don't know. There's some weird ways of collecting your money, I tell you.
Did you ever have to use any of those when you were on your own?
Oh, yeah. See, Richard and I would have this trick. See, Richard did most of the talking, and sometimes, you know.
This is Richard Cousins, your bassist?
Richard Cousins, a bass player, you know. Since I was really quiet, and Richard did all the talking, he would go and collect the money for us when we were traveling by ourselves without a tour manager, you know. And if he had a problem and the club owner was trying to take the money from the door, he'd say, "Now, you don't want me to go back and get Robert, do you?" And sometimes I would have to walk in. And I had this, I can put on this scowling face. See, and everybody knew me as one that wouldn't say anything. But, you know, not knowing what my reaction might be physically, I mean, they were scared even, you know, to take that challenge, you know. And a couple times I did have to walk in, and I'd walk into the office, and I'd just sit there with this look on my face, and we get our money.
Robert Cray, from his new album, Midnight Stroll, this is The Things You Do to Me.
It's been so long, I really need to see you, baby. So long, when I called you up and talked to you yesterday, baby, you really rocked me. Oh, you rock me. I made my promise to you, darling, and I'm gonna do what needs be done. You've made me understand, baby, that hearts ain't made from stone.
This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is joining us from NPR Washington. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. Defense Secretary Dick Cheney, along with Colin Powell, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, make the Bush administration's case in the Persian Gulf conflict in front of the Senate Armed Services Committee. The so-called suicide doctor who put together a device to help a woman commit suicide has now been charged with murder. Two reports on the possibility of an earthquake in the Midwest and Missouri. One about how the town, the small town of New Madrid, is handling the publicity, and one on the predictor of the quake, Ivan Browning. Also a farewell to Aaron Copland, the composer who died yesterday at age 90.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Ted Turner's TNT Network is presenting a documentary tribute to Greta Garbo. It premieres tonight and will be repeated this Saturday. TV critic David Bianculli has high praise for Garbo, but not for what TV's done to her.
When Greta Garbo arrived in Hollywood in 1924, she was a frightened 19-year-old Swedish girl who didn't speak English. When she vanished from the screen 16 years and 24 movies later, she was a goddess. The most glamorous, mysterious movie star in the world.
That's Glenn Close, the host of The Divine Garbo. This new TNT special is a combination biography and filmography, written by Newsweek movie critic David Anson. It's a little like one of those wonderful American Masters documentaries on PBS, except that The Divine Garbo is a lot less divine. There are no interviews, no new personal details, only a not very critical overview of Garbo's movies. It's a high-speed romp through her films, paying special attention to the pieces that made up the Garbo legend. Her reclusive nature, for example, is played up in a quick montage of lines from her later movies.
I want to be alone.
We want to be alone.
But one day I shall find myself alone.
I want to be alone.
I shall probably be quite alone.
Maybe you'd rather be alone.
We were afraid you might be getting pretty lonely.
You seem so lonely, Yvonne.
No more than usual. I just want to be alone.
You want to be alone, comrade?
No.
And, of course, there's the famous scene in Queen Christina, where Greta Garbo surrenders her crown, a bit of symbolism that isn't lost on the makers of this documentary.
In retrospect, Queen Christina's abdication scene seems to anticipate her own renunciation of Hollywood stardom.
I am grateful for your loyalty. But there is a voice in our souls which tells us what to do and we obey. I have no choice.
But even though the Divine Garbo presents snippets from all of Garbo's films and has early commercials and late screen tests as a bonus, the program doesn't do what it has to do. Except in one or two well-chosen scenes, it doesn't explain the Garbo mystique. It doesn't show, convincingly enough, what made her such a fine actress and such a memorable movie star. For that, you have to turn to her movies. And here's where TNT deserves all the praise it can get. Along with this new documentary, TNT is presenting 11 of Garbo's old films this week, including some of her little-seen silent films. Tonight, after the documentary, TNT shows the well-known Camille and the little-seen 1926 silent film, Flesh and the Devil. This Saturday, a Garbo marathon includes such rarities as 1931's Susan Lennox, Her Rise and Fall, which co-stars Clark Gable, and Garbo's 1928 silent movie, A Woman of Affairs. These movies, not the documentary, show Garbo at her best. But if the documentaries are the reason TNT is digging deep within its movie vaults, I say keep making them. One superficial hour in exchange for nearly a dozen classy movies is a trade I'd make any day.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers are Richard Parker, Thad Kirk, Dan Lachlan, and Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, education historian Diane Ravitch on the importance of a multicultural curriculum for our schools and the importance of steering clear of the self-serving demands of ethnic, religious, and racial groups. Also, Wendy Smith tells us about the history of one of America's most influential acting ensembles, the Group Theater. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.